Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
What's good, y'all? It's Von Miller, Super Bowl MVP, Sag Master, and now your host of Free Range. This is where NFL meets real talk. Every week, I'm bringing you inside the game, from locker room stories to league-wide headlines. You want football IQ, locker room insight, and real conversations with the people shaping the league? Welcome to Free Range with Von Miller, where nothing is off limits and every down counts. New episodes every Wednesday. Listen and follow Free Range with me, Von Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with somebody that you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One.
You try to impart that on the guys now, that like, this is what's possible. You can have these moments that transcend team, that transcend program, and that bring people together in this magical way. And that's the only way to describe that period in time. Magical. I'll probably coach the rest of my life trying to find that moment again.
And our guest this week is Bobby Hughes. He is the head men's basketball coach at Division III Rosemont College on the main line. And coach, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to me a little bit about what life's been like for you the last several months, just as far as trying to be a basketball coach in the midst of a pandemic.
Yeah, it's funny, Matt. When this all started, the last normal thing I did was go down to D.C. and see Hofstra win the CAA championship last year. I'd gone down and my wife and I had talked about it and said, oh, should we do this? Should I not do this? And that, I think it was Tuesday night. And then everything broke Wednesday and Thursday. And looking back, it seems so irresponsible now. But at the time, you felt so normal doing it. And little did I know that would just disappear. And those first couple months were tough. I mean, you really couldn't do much. I mean, I was home the whole time. You could recruit, but you could organize. We organized Zoom calls with our players, with our alumni, you know, that sort of thing. But there was nothing to do. So I think so much of being a coach is having contact, having FaceTime with your players. And it was just taken away so abruptly that you didn't even know how to respond. And at times you questioned, you know, what are we doing here? Like, what is the purpose of what I'm doing? And that started to change. And the recruiting piece was great because you could spend more time on that. I mean, a lot of times, especially at the Division III level, you're juggling so many things that sometimes you can't get to this event, or you have to put this call off until another time, whatever it is. So we were able to focus on recruiting. We actually ended up getting a great class, and things became a little bit more normal in the summer. You could go to some events. You could go to some workouts. This fall was tough. I think we always had that promise of a season sitting out there, and you hoped that the numbers would get better. We started to run some workouts, and then we had to get shut down pretty abruptly because of a positive test, which was disappointing. And then, you know, as the numbers spiked, it just became obvious that this wasn't going to happen. So trying to bring some normalcy to our players' lives, I think, is the number one priority. And we'll see how we can do that this semester, whether that's just running workouts or practices, maybe even getting in some games. But I'd be lying if I didn't say it's been a very challenging part of my life.
Has this changed things for you with coaching permanently? And when I say that, I don't mean maybe how you look at it, maybe how you recruit, you know, has it changed the way you approach things?
Absolutely. What COVID has shown me is how important the relationship part of this profession is. And we all get caught up at times in the day-to-day grind of the X's and O's and the planning and the recruiting, the planning of recruiting. And this idea of winning and losing. And it is important. Don't get me wrong. Like, we're competitive people. We want to compete. We want to win. We want to go and achieve. But at the same time, this profession is about building relationships and manifesting those relationships into very meaningful experiences. And usually that is manifested in winning. But that was the thing that got taken away first and foremost, was that contact. So I think just that appreciation of the people who you surround yourself with, whether it's your staff, whether it's the people at the school, certainly your players, and having a deep appreciation and an ability to understand that that's why you do this, is for that connection and that ability to uplift the community. And that's what we're ultimately, I think, you know, going to appreciate more when we get back to being a community. So absolutely, you know, it kind of lays bare some of the less important things. And you know you're going to get back to doing those things, but at the same time, maybe you'll have a different perspective on it.
So let's talk a little bit about your story. Growing up, where was basketball on the depth chart of sports? Were you a basketball guy, or were you a whatever's in season and whatever they're playing in the neighborhood I'm playing?
Yeah, I mean, we played everything growing up. I mean, I grew up in Westchester, played most sports, didn't play football. That was the only thing I really didn't play. And I was probably, as a youth, best at baseball. I mean, I'll be honest. Like, I tell this to my players all the time. I was never a good basketball player, like, ever. I was never a good basketball player. But I loved basketball. And my earliest sports memories are basketball memories. And for me, the game kind of surrounded my life from a very young age. My parents were both heavily involved, you know, in our local CYO. My mom eventually was the athletic director at St. Maximilian Colby in Westchester. My dad coached the eighth grade boys. My mom coached the eighth grade girls in addition to her other responsibilities. So with a large family, I'm the oldest of six, from, I don't know, the time I was 10 years old or 11 years old, we were in the gyms all the time, three, four nights a week, every day, most days on Saturdays, every day, most days on Sundays. We didn't even have a gym at that time. We actually it's funny, they're a competitor of ours now and used to be in our conference. We would spend a lot of time in Immaculata on those weekends. And that's where we would have our practices. And, you know, the second grade and third grade teams would come in, then the third and fourth grade and so on and so forth. So for me, you know, my life just seemed always, basketball just always seemed to be a part of it for whatever reason, even as I wasn't the best basketball player. So when I got into high school, I wanted to stay involved and became a manager and, you know, kept that going through St. Joe's. And, you know, again, I eventually got pretty good at golf, but.
Did you, as a manager, and for people that aren't familiar, especially at the college level, manager is a hard job. It's a lot of organizational. It's a lot of, you know, behind the scenes stuff. You don't get a lot of glory. But were you looking at this? Was it just a way to be connected to basketball? Or are you starting to think, I could coach, this is a way I can kind of get in there, learn without being a player?
No, absolutely. I wanted to coach pretty early on. I looked at coaches really from high school on and said, that's something that I want to consider doing. I had a lot of thoughts and a lot of ideas and a lot of interests, but coaching was always one of those things that I kept coming back to. So when I got to St. Joe's, my high school, the guy who ran our high school program at Malvern, who coincidentally is now my assistant coach, Bud Tosti, had gotten me in touch with Phil Martelli, and Phil had very kindly invited me to be a manager and included me in the program. And managers, you know, are, like you said, I think play a crucial role in any department. I think the nice thing about the way the managers worked at St. Joe's is Phil had a mantra, and he lived it every single day, that the managers are here with us, not for us. And that set a tone early on that of inclusivity that really enabled me, I think, to develop some really meaningful relationships again at a time where, again, I'm not going to lie, I wish I could tell this story about me being this great. I wasn't a very good manager because I think I wanted to be a coach. I wanted to be more important than I necessarily was. But that didn't stop Phil from inviting me to watch film from him, including me in parts of things, you know, answering my questions when I had them about the scouting reports, whatever it may be. And just that opportunity to be at St. Joe's at that time, you know, Jameer was a year younger than me, Delonte 2 years younger than me. It was a magical time at St. Joe's. So I got lucky in so many ways that I had these doors opened up for me that I didn't have to do anything. So to be associated with those people, it just really crystallized, again, that love of this game. And after college, you know, I went into working in the corporate world right away, and I knew early on that it wasn't for me. And I kept looking for every avenue to get back into coaching.
The choice of St. Joe's for college, was that discussion or the connection with Coach Martelli made before you get to college? Like it, or is it you'd already chosen St. Joe's and then it's, hey, let's try this? Like, what went into going to Hawk Hill?
Yeah, so both my parents went to St. Joe's. So, you know, St. Joe's, being a St. Joe's fan was always part of my youth. You know, my dad was definitely more of like a Big Five fan. You know, growing up, he would root for, you know, other schools. My mom was a hardcore St. Joe's fan. She actually has this great book. She kept every newspaper clipping that involved St. Joe's. I have it at my house now. I mean, almost, I can't say everyone, but I mean, the book is 3 or 4 inches thick of newspaper clippings from St. Joe's from probably 1961 or 62 through 1963 or 64. It's an incredible piece of history of St. Joe's basketball. And so when I, you know, started looking at schools, I looked at all like Division I schools and wanted to work. And then Phil came out to do like a clinic for my mom's CYO program one night, you know, when I was a senior at Malvern, and I talked to him there and he invited me. And then, you know, over the summer, I think that Bud may have talked to him a little bit about me, and he sent me this nice note just reminding me that I had a place there. So it was, I felt welcome right away. I felt welcome right away there. And I think that the decision for St. Joe's was definitely part of being part of that family.
So that time frame you mentioned, Jameer Nelson, Delonte West, we're talking 2003, 2004. You know they're very good, and you know what you're watching. But at that young age, do you appreciate the magnitude of what a school that size that was performing on the national stage and undefeated regular season and number one seed in the NCAA tournament? Did you appreciate how remarkable that was?
I, you know what? It's funny, Matt, you asked the question that way, because my first year was 99-2000, and we were okay that year. We were okay. It wasn't great. You know, I think slightly below 500. But at the end of the year, we knocked off Temple at the Palestra when they were fifth in the country, Pepe Sanchez and all those guys. And that was the first time that I really felt, wow, this is different. Like, there's something special about this that goes beyond just being a basketball program, like you said, in the small school. Like, and then Jameer got there and everything just changed. And you knew it right away. You knew, even at that age, even at 20 years old or whatever I was exactly, you knew you were watching someone special. Like, I can't even, I remember his visit, his official visit. We actually had to go out to Cardinal O'Hara to practice. Something was happening in the field house. I don't remember what it was. So I sat there on the sidelines at Cardinal O'Hara with Jameer Nelson. And I, even then, like, you knew that he was just a little bit different and just a little bit, you know, I don't even know how to describe it, but like, you just knew. And watching him in practice every day for 3 years was just a true gift. I mean, to see his leadership in action, I use it with all my players to this day. Like, it's hard to actually put into words, but and there's markers as you go through. You know, he hits the shot versus St. Bonaventure to force overtime from half court, and that first run my sophomore year when we almost beat Stanford in the second round of the tournament. The injuries and the disappointment of the junior year, and then for my senior year was, you know, we graduated, you know, all these great players: Naeem Crenshaw, Bill Phillips, Marvin O'Connor, Damian Reed, four thousand point scorers going into that year. Like, you knew you were good. You knew in practice that things were even different, you know, but you still went up. And we went up my first game that year. We played Boston College, and you know, I remember being on the bus on the way over there and thinking, man, we're like thinking like this team has a chance to be really good. But like, what does that mean? And, you know, Boston College was pretty good that year and they just whooped them. And those guys just went out there and they just took it to them. And you knew what you were up for. And so, yeah, like I think that's the other thing when it comes to coaching for me, that you try to put across your players. Like, you've seen those special teams. You've been a part of those moments. And the next year I wasn't working with the team, but I was traveling around the country with Mike Farrelly, who's, you know, now the acting coach at Hofstra. And Mike and I went to like every game together. And, you know, you try to impart that on the guys now that like, this is what's possible. You can have these moments that transcend team, that transcend program, and then bring people together in this magical way. And that's the only way to describe that period in time, is magical. And I'll probably coach the rest of my life trying to find that moment again.
So you graduate 03, correct?
Yep.
And you mentioned you went into the corporate world. Did you pursue at that point something coaching-wise, or was it just, I got my degree, now I've got to go put it to use?
Not right away. What had happened is as an alum who was, you know, big, good, you know, a donor to the program and very involved in our booster club, had come up to me after a game and had commented, you know, that he heard about me or whatever, and just gave me his card and said, hey, when you get out of college, if you need a job, give me a call. So I called him about, you know, early in the summer, and his company, which was a big, big company, Conagra Foods, this big conglomerate, hired me. And, you know, it was a lot of money and a company car and an expense report and nice people. And I gave it a shot, but I knew right away, like, I was never unhappy in it. Like, I wasn't one of these people that went to work and like hated their life. Like, I had a good life, but I knew that coaching, I wanted to coach again. So when Mike Farrelly became the head coach of the JV team and their Conagra did a layoff and I got laid off and I moved back into the Philadelphia area, I was driving a limousine, and he said, well, hey, why don't you just come and help me with JV? And I said, sure. And even after that, I would work in a couple more corporate jobs, but I would do the JV for the 1 year with him. And then 2 years after, I knew that I wanted to coach. So when the opportunity presented itself in early 2008 to pursue it 100%, I just went for it. And thankfully, you know, that's when I got involved in Division III and been involved in Division III ever since.
What was the biggest thing you learned from Phil Martelli about coaching, and specifically coaching at the college level?
I think organization, and also the scouting piece of it, the ability to plan. And I think those two things go hand in hand. I mean, he was religious about watching film, about planning practice, those types of things. He didn't waste any time in those things. So from a technical perspective, but even from an from being a manager, I saw the levels of organization he had and the thought that he put into travel in terms of, you know, when we're doing what, when, what we're doing when. And that was always so important to him. And I realized that it takes that level of organization to be successful. But from an actual basketball perspective, you know, our teams, those St. Joe's teams, were just always so prepared. They were always so ready to play. And I knew that that came not just from putting a bunch of words or putting a bunch of stats on paper, but it came from hours and hours of watching film. When my senior year, he had this thing. We used to have this bag. He had the VHS tape. So we'd have this bag that held like maybe, I don't know, 15 VHS tapes in it. And for whatever reason, he didn't want to have the bag in his room because I guess he thought maybe he would, you know, stay up all night watching film, which is inevitably what he did anyways. So I kept the bag in my room. And, you know, again, there's all of a sudden at 12:30 or 1 o'clock, the call would come. Hey, Barney, can you bring me down, you know, this tape and this tape? And, you know, it was always funny. But at the same time, like I took away from that opportunity, you know, that knowledge that this is what it takes to be successful at the college level as a coach. It takes this level of preparation, and you have to put those hours in. I mean, you have to put those hours in, and it's time. And that's the thing I think that you have to be ready to sacrifice for this job is your time to really focus on that film.
I asked you the question if you appreciated what you got to see from a pure basketball standpoint. At that young age, you're almost getting a coaching clinic every day on a daily basis, be it X and O or how you run a high-quality program. Was there appreciation at the age of 19, 20, 21 of what you were getting a front-row seat to, or was that, you know, 2008, 2009, 2010, once you get waist-deep into it, you're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe what I was privy to.
Yeah, no, I absolutely think that there was not an appreciation for that right away. I did not know what I was witnessing. And it wasn't until I got involved in basketball at a deeper level and saw how other people did things. And that's not to, you know, be disparaging to anyone. It just surprised me that everyone wasn't as organized, wasn't as thorough. And it doesn't mean I was a good person doing scouting reports and everything first. I wasn't. Like, I had to learn, too. Like, it didn't come just naturally when I got my first job. In fact, you know, I can remember being yelled at and told, this is garbage, by my first boss, which is fine. He was right. I had to go through those growing pains. But I think having the knowledge of knowing what I had seen as a young man, and then being able to apply it in a very, very, you know, real way as a young coach, that allowed me to, you know, put that, not just the knowledge that I was growing and learning as a coach in those 07 to 010, you know, 2010 years, but then also applying what I had seen with my own eyes and been a part of as a young man at St. Joe's. That it was a good blend for me. It was a good mix for me. And I think it ultimately helped me, you know, develop as a coach, you know, that I am now.
So we mentioned you're coaching JV at St. Joe's, and then the door opens, I believe, at Drew.
Yeah.
And talk about how that door opens. What's the connection to get you in the door there as an assistant?
Yeah. So I had left a job working in Old City, Philadelphia, and right by Independence Hall, my office. I could look out and see Independence Hall from my cubicle. It was a great place to work from a location, and I really enjoyed it. But I had, it wasn't the best fit for me, and they wanted to move in a different direction. And I had thankfully had some money, you know, that I had saved up, and thought, okay, well, we can make this run. And I started working all these hoop group events, these grassroots type events. I mean, basically worked every event they ran for like 6 months. And I started to get involved with this job and that job. And there was this ops director. There was this grad assistant job. There was this, and nothing ever happened. Like nothing. I mean, it was conversation. I had probably three or four interviews, and it was just disappointment after disappointment. And finally, I was kind of resolved to going back and doing JV and going and driving the limo again and maybe making one more run at it the following year. And this was coinciding with the Phillies. And I'm a huge Phillies fan. I was a season ticket holder at the time making their run in 08. So all of a sudden, I want to say, you know, October 15th is the start of basketball practice. I would say on October 7th or 8th, my phone rang. And it was Daryl Keckler at Drew, and he had gotten my number from Dave Duda, who was the assistant coach at St. Joe's at the time, had been at Widener, and Dave knew Daryl through another guy, because Daryl was the assistant at Gettysburg, and Gettysburg had just made a Sweet 16 run, and Daryl asked me if I wanted to coach with him, and I never met him, I didn't know him, and you know we were the same age too, which was a crazy thing. And he was going up to Drew, which had, you know, had a really rough run of it. So he called me up. We talked a few times. I met him for the first time, and I met the team for the first time on October 15th. So I'm walking into our first practice, shaking everyone's hand and saying, hey, how you doing? And that year was a trial by fire. Not only was I an inexperienced guy in terms of doing all the things that an assistant needs to do, I was, you know, we were not very good. We finished the year 4-21. It was not enjoyable from that perspective. But it was a great learning, lesson for me. And the year, thankfully, with Daryl's guidance and help. And again, he was really, I'm just so thankful that he gave me the opportunity when no one else would. And, in this business, you people that give you opportunities, you're just eternally grateful for them because they're so few and far between.
How much did the timing of that, because it is, like you said, first day of practice, you're shaking hands and you're meeting your boss and everything mm-hmm. on the fly. How much does that almost help you don't outthink yourself? And it's just, let's just go out there and take it one day at a time. And, I would imagine as challenging it is on some ways, it almost maybe is helpful in others.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it teaches you very quickly how much you don't know about things. So you have to really reframe everything to learning, listening, and then being able to try to teach that. I mean, Daryl came from Gettysburg, where they ran a lot of Princeton stuff. His way of organizing practice, which I've actually stolen a lot from and use here now, even to this day, was different from the way I was accustomed to seeing Phil done things. Because really, other than Bud Tosti and Phil Martelli, I really hadn't seen, on a day-to-day basis, the way people ran practices. So it was helpful in that I knew pretty early on to keep my mouth shut as much as I could and try to learn. But it was also a great education because, learning something like the Princeton, which you see, elements of in all levels of basketball now. I mean, to the point where some of the stuff that nobody else was doing 12 years ago is so common now, it's kind of odd. It was a great way of learning. And again, it didn't lack for its failures, most of them on my end. I mean, I remember one of the first times I had to do a live scout. It wasn't by film, so you couldn't hit pause and rewind and everything. And I ran into a coaching friend and we're talking as this scout is taking place. And I realized I'm not able to have a conversation and pay attention to basketball at the same time. In fact, I'm really, really bad at it. Handing that live scout back to my boss and then losing the game and having him, having him get mad at me for it is one of the best lessons that this game's ever given me. And because it teaches you that, you have to be able to come through with stuff. You have to be able to do, it's not just about trying at this level. I mean, you actually have to be able to accomplish something and put something together.
So after Drew, you go to Washington in Maryland, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And when do you start? You guys had some success at Washington. When do you start to really feel like I'm getting close to being ready to give my own program a shot?
Well, I probably felt like I was close when I was 19. And now sitting here at 40, having been a head coach at Rosemont since 2012, I know how much I didn't know even then. But to answer your question, I knew that I really wanted to start pursuing head coaching opportunities. That's during that second year. I thought that I was ready at this level to be able to do this. I don't know if that was an accurate statement. I'm not sure I was right about that. I don't think you're ever really ready. There's things about you can talk about it all you want, and it's cliche to say, moving that 18 inches is down the bench is moving a mile, but it's the truth. So we had a nice year that didn't end well. We had some injuries down the stretch that kind of hurt us, but we had a great season overall. It was a very memorable season at Washington. And, the education I got from Rob Nugent down there, I'm thankful again for the formative years with Phil. I'm thankful for Daryl hiring me and teaching me the ropes. Rob Nugent, the fact that he's not a college basketball coach right now is just it's a tragedy. He's one of the smartest basketball men I've ever met. And he taught me a way of looking at the game that I had never, really even thought of or didn't think was possible. So, and he was so religious to film. I mean, he on level with Phil, and I hadn't seen that up close in that way. I mean, just the amount of like 3 a.m., 4 a.m., you know, mornings with him. I mean, and the memorable mornings, you know, not just like, oh, what are we doing here? I mean, at times where you were like engrossed in it, you know, to a nerdy, you know, degree. You're like, oh, this is great. You know, my friends are all still probably out at the bars and everything. And I'm sitting here trying to figure out how to, you know, defend Franklin and Marshall's same plays they've been running for 35 years. Anyway, I thought from that education, I thought that Rob had set me up well to do it. And I'm so appreciative of that opportunity, because without seeing him operate firsthand, I don't think I would have had the confidence to say, and I don't mean the confidence to stand in front of a room and interview. I mean the internal confidence to stand in front of your team and say, I've prepared you to play basketball today. And, you know, again, he was so giving as a teacher that I really, for me, a very selfish person, it taught me very much to try to, you know, see things, you know, outside of my very self-centered perspective. So, again, that was it. And I was very confident going into that summer that hopefully, you know, I'd find something, as a head coach or move up a level or something like that.
So you do find the opportunity at Rosemont. How's it come about? And what did you know about Rosemont before the head coach opening comes on your radar?
So I'd actually interviewed at Rosemont when they went co-ed. I'd actually gotten an interview, I think mostly on the strength of Phil's recommendation for me. And so I knew the AD a little bit from that first interview. So I think that was helpful. And I had just gone through another process with another university as a head coach. So I had just gone through the process. And I think through that process, I'd kind of try to tell them what I thought they wanted to hear rather than talk about who I am. And with Rosemont, I didn't do that. It's funny because that was the summer of 2012. And we talk about opportunity and opportunity being scarce in this business. I actually, the morning that Rosemont offered me the job, that evening, a Division I coach offered me a position on their staff. And so after years of getting very few opportunities, I get two on the exact same day. And some people had worked very hard to help me get that Division I opportunity. So I felt very obligated in a way to see that out and to try to explore that. But I think in my own mind, and I remember talking to my now wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, about it. And I wanted the opportunity to do my own thing. I wanted the opportunity to run my own program. And as a guy who wasn't a great player, who wasn't a great manager either, to be able to go out as a coach and say, I can take this program and make something of it. I think that was, you know, it was certainly egotistical. It certainly is something, maybe a little arrogance on my part. But I remember in the 48 hours where I was considering the two jobs, talking to someone, and I don't even remember who the person is at this point. And they told me, well, you can never win, you know, you can never have a winning record at Rosemont. Like, it won't happen. So why would you not take the Division I opportunity? And I just remember even now, like then, just thinking, no, you know what, I can do this. Like, we can overcome some of the obstacles at this school, and we can make something of it. And, you know, we have a long way to go, but overall, you know, I think there's a lot to be proud of about making that decision. And I'm very glad that I did. And you know, it's enabled me not just to have some professional, you know, success, but certainly a lot of, personal success as well.
So you get the job. Are you at any point overwhelmed, or do you feel, you know, your experience, what you've seen? I always ask athletes when they go from high school to college or college to pro, what's the biggest adjustment? And 99 out of 100 times, it's speed of the game. It's adjusting to. Did you have a similar, obviously not speed of the game, but speed of what's expected of you and what your day-to-day challenges are becoming a head coach, and were you ready for it?
The speed of the game is a thing. I mean, I remember the first game I coached, and that seemed like we played Eastern here, and I remember thinking that game lasted 25 minutes, like in real time, compared to recent games where you feel like they last 3 or 4 hours because they've slowed down. But that, so right away, that wasn't it. It hit me when we started playing. For me, there was a moment of terror about, I'd say, 3 to 5 weeks before the season started. And my wife and I were out one night and we were talking about this, and somebody had asked me like a pretty, like a prodding question about what I was doing. They weren't a basketball person, and I kind of just glossed over it. And I went home that night, and I was living with my parents at the time, and I was in my old like childhood bedroom. And I just remember all of a sudden thinking, how am I going to guard ball screens? And realizing that there was no one there to tell me how we were going to do it, I had to come up with this and every rotation and everything else after. And I had to like, and I hadn't thought of it to that level of a micro detail that like, that it, I couldn't just say like, okay, this is what we're going to do. I had to actually go out and put all this stuff down. And it, you know, I did not sleep. I don't think I went to bed that night. Like, I just, all of a sudden, all these things that I had to do, it seemed insurmountable that we could get to a point where we'd be able to teach all of it. And obviously you can tell through this conversation now and in my general life, I'm a very verbose person. I have a lot of words to say, and I sometimes get very tangential in the manner in which I speak and the stories that I tell. But I'm very different, I think, when I coach, in that I'm very specific about what I say and how I say it. And I try to be repetitive in the types of words that I use. And that was, again, advice from Phil Martelli, because he knew the type of person I was. And he's like, you can't coach like this. You can't do this. So I had to think a lot about what, I mean, and write out what I was going to say. And you didn't want it to be scripted, but you also couldn't, I couldn't just be me. It had to be some new thing that kind of coalesced behind, you know, this idea of who you are as a coach. And, you know, the last thing I'll say is around that same time, I watched a documentary. It was that, remember when Conan left the Tonight Show, right? And he did that documentary about him. And he said something very interesting that somebody asked him, like, how are you so comfortable around world leaders and famous actors and actresses and authors and so on and so forth all the time? And he said that somebody had told him along the way that, you know, act like you've been there before. So those first couple months, I mean, I think that's all I did, is I just acted like I'd been a head coach for 10 years, whether I entirely knew everything or not. And I think eventually I settled into who I was on the floor very, very quickly.
Time for a break on One-on-One. We will have more with Rosemont College men's basketball coach Bobby Hughes right after this. And we are back on One-on-One. Our guest this week, Rosemont College men's basketball coach Bobby Hughes. So since you've been at Rosemont, you've built the program, you've had a lot of success. The conference has changed. Mm-hmm. A lot of teams that were in your conference went and formed their own conference. Talk a little bit about that, because it was schools like Cabrini, Gwinnett Mercy, Newman, a lot of heavy hitters that, yeah, you know, and it completely changed the dynamic of what the CSAC was all about. And you guys are still in the conference. What was that like as, you know, half the old guard gets up and leaves?
Matt, it's disappointing. It was disappointing because those were some really, really good rivalries. And when I came into the conference, Cabrini was coming off of a national championship runner-up. And they had one of the best players in the country, if not the best and most talented player in the country. When I came here, one of our goals was, you know, not just, like, we wanted to be competitive. Like, that was one of the things. Like, we wanted to be competitive. The program was only 3 years old. They had made the playoffs once, and, you know, which was a great thing for the school, and the previous coach did a tremendous job of getting them there and kind of laying that foundation. But I wanted to be consistently competitive, not to the point where, you know, you could possibly win, but you should win, or you're considered, hey, we're part of this. So one of the things we said we had to do was we had to beat Cabrini, we had to beat Newman, we had to beat Gwinnett. Like, it wasn't just enough to show up and give a great effort. Like, we had to go and beat these teams, and it took a couple years. But I was so proud that one of the things I was most proud about in the older iteration is, you know, we were able to do that. Not consistently, not all the time, but we were able to beat those teams. And certainly we were competitive in almost every single game with those teams. So along the way, we developed great rivalries with them, and you get that taken away. It stinks. It's not what you want, but you adjust. I mean, at the end of the day, since then, we've developed great rivalry with Cairn, and I think with Centenary. And these are teams that were there, and even with Wilson, who came into our league as a new team 2 years ago, you know, we've had just tremendous games with them since they've come into the conference. So that stuff sort of adjusts. You know, it's disappointing because Cabrini's 2 miles away. Newman is 25 minutes away. Gwinnett is 20 minutes away. And for our students who could come there, it created these great atmospheres. So it certainly, you know, isn't, I think, the ideal situation from a fan perspective. But, you know, you can't worry about that when you're actually coaching. You know, you just go out and say, all right, well, you know, we want to be at the top of this conference. That's our goal. Our goal is to be at the top of this conference every single year. And, you know, hopefully we're able to do that.
You were able to do that the 2018-2019 season. You guys win the conference. You go to the NCAA tournament. What's that year like? And when does it start to crystallize that you've got a group that could do something like that?
We knew the whole year. I mean, we were the favorite to win the league that year. We had a ton of talent on the team, so the expectations were pretty high. But we got off to a rough start, and that rough start continued through the middle of the year, which was disappointing. We had some issues with some personnel, and some of that took care of itself naturally. Some of it, you know, we had to force, unfortunately. And, you know, things started to turn in January that year, and it started to come together. We made some changes from an offensive perspective, some wrinkles here and there. I think we realized that the guy who ended up being the most outstanding player of our conference tournament, Keith Blassingale, we realized how important he was to our offense. So we tried to make him a focal point. And then, you know, we had, you know, a stretch right in the beginning of January that didn't go our way. And then Arcadia, who was, you know, right outside the top 25 at the time, they were tremendous. They had a tremendous year. They went to the second round of the tournament. They came into our building, you know, in mid-January. And, you know, I don't think, you know, from an outsider's perspective, a lot of people thought we could win, and we won that game. We had a hot shooting night. It was great. And you thought, okay, great. Things have turned. Two nights later, we go to Immaculata, and now this is a non-conference game. And the previous 4 years, we had played at Immaculata. This is a true story. The previous four games at Immaculata in those 4 years were all one-point games. Each one of them was a one-point game. And I'm expecting another barn burner, and they just whoop us. We had no interest in being there. And I remember saying to my assistant, Bud, coming out, I remember saying, Coach Tosti, I'm not sure we can lose one more game. our psyche just might not be able to handle it. And thankfully we went on a run and we didn't lose again until the NCAA tournament. And give the guys credit. I think a lot of it had to do with their ability to really, going back to what I've talked about, take the game plans and really put them in action the rest of the way, because the guys did such a great job of being ready to play. And through injuries and through the other personnel stuff, like when it came to the ball going up in the air, they were ready to play. And that run, that 8-game, 7-game, whatever it is, run that we made is just so, so indelible in my mind, because whereas every day kind of, you know, was frustrating because we were always curious, like, could we get to the next day? Can we get there? Can we do this? Come game time, like, there were very few times on the sideline where I wasn't sitting there like, oh, man, we're good. Like, we're in control of this. And that's a nice thing to have as a coach is to have that feeling of you know, control, because you don't usually have that feeling.
What was that? The clock strikes zero in the conference championship game, and you're headed to the NCAA tournament. What's the rush of emotions at that moment?
It's bonkers. It was a great basketball game. Give credit. So Cairn hosted. They have a really great Division III gym. You know, it's just like a perfect Division III gym in a lot of ways. I don't know if it sits 800, 1,000 people. I don't know what it sits, but they had people everywhere. I mean, you could, I'm sure the fire marshal was not allowed on campus that night. And it was loud. It was hot. I mean, we had people standing behind our bench. I mean, three, four people deep. And it was back and forth. We took a big lead. They came back. They took a lead. We got the lead at halftime. I mean, it was just one of those back and forth, just you're just trying to get to the next possession every single time. And they took like a 5-point lead with 5 minutes remaining. And we went on a run and are able to, you know, take the lead, but, you know, into the last minute, and they just keep hitting shots. And I remember Jaleel Myers, who was a senior all conference player for us, he makes a free throw to put us up by three. And no one has timeouts left or anything like that. But, you know, we had fouled right before that up three with like 8 seconds left or 9 seconds left. And they had made two. We inbounded. We made two. I don't know if they thought we were going to foul again or not, but we told our guys, like, don't. And we had a call at the time, and their best player, who was the conference player in the year last year, tries to go behind his back, and our junior captain, Nick Gemmel, like, comes up with the ball. He throws, you know, he does like the old, like, throw the ball into the rafters kind of thing. And I have a picture of it right here on my desk, and of the moment. I remember putting my hands up and immediately turning to hug Coach Tosti. And, you know, it was a culmination of so many failures and so many obstacles to be able to say that this group of guys were able to overcome that. I mean, even that season was so many obstacles. It's why we do this. And then to see the community, I mean, we had a bunch of fans there, a couple hundred fans there, rushed the court, and, you know, it was special.
And then was the NCAA tournament, after a rush of emotion like that, was it almost like, oh, by the way, now we've got to play one of the best teams in the country in Amherst? I mean, after, like, you the way you describe that, it means so much. But then there's still more to do. And there's more to do against a phenomenal program. How difficult was the challenge of recharging the kids and kind of climbing the mountain again?
Not difficult, honestly. I give them a ton of credit that year. You know, we were not just there to just go through the motions. But I told them at every step, like, we need to enjoy this. We need to enjoy, you know, we had talked about the night before the championship game. I had brought them in and told them all, like, you know, I had them all close their eyes. And I told them to picture, you know, that post game. And I told them, like, you know, guys, close your eyes. Like, everyone, your loved ones are around you. The scoreboard's at zero. Rosemont is led. The game is over. And I was like, the ladder's up. I was like, the ladder's up, and someone hands you a pair of scissors. I was like, now open your eyes and go make it happen. And so just that experience for them, I told them all, like, as they went up, I was like, look around, like, enjoy this. And then when we had the announcement of Amherst, I said, you know, same thing. I was like, enjoy this moment, this selection moment. And the next day in practice, you know, we had cameras there from the local press. Enjoy this moment, guys. Enjoy this. Like, take this in. But then when we get on the floor, focus. You know, when that came, like, I was like, now, you know, we need this focus. And I don't, you know, we don't practice a ton towards the end of the year. I've never been a coach that believes in long, like, 2-hour practices towards the end of the year. I think you come in and you get your stuff. But they were so used to my game planning that when it came to Amherst, they never treated it like anything big. I knew it was big. when I saw Amherst come up before our name, I was like, oh, here we go. I was like, I knew it. There's just some, like, extra sensory thing that, like, you're about to see Rosemont. But for me, that was awesome to play Dave Hickson, one of the greatest Division III, greatest college coaches in history, in that first game. And I remember shaking his hand, and I just said, you know, this is an honor. And, you know, it was incredibly amazing. And but to also go in and be like, guys, we are going in there to win this game. Like, we are going in to win it. I remember it vividly. You know, we had this whole idea. We run some Princeton stuff, some chin stuff. And, you know, we had this idea. I mean, they're huge. I mean, their starting lineup was like 6'2", 6'5", 6'6", 6'8", 6'11". You know, so they had us every position. And we wanted to bring, you know, so we flopped our guards and our forwards. And we said, okay, this is what we're going to do to bring that size away from the basket. We're going to try to give our best player a chance to make plays in the middle of the floor. And that first half, I mean, first of all, we defended them great. I mean, I was so, like, it was our best game. It was our best 30 minutes, I should say. This is the best consistent 30 minutes of basketball we played. And we just defended them with everything we had, and we kept the game close. And we had a shot at halftime that if it goes in, I think it would have been, rather than a 7 or 8 point game, it was a 4 or 5 point game. And I think if that goes in, you know, maybe the second half takes a different turn. But I told our guys, I was like, guys, listen, I fully expect them to have like 8 blocks. At halftime, because if they have 8 blocks, it means we're attacking, not worried about them blocking shots. And we did. I think we went into halftime. I think they had 9 blocks. And unfortunately, the other shots that I thought would go in didn't go in. And that's the, you know, when you're playing a team with that much talent, that much history, that much tradition, you know, those are the things you have to do. And, you know, again, I wouldn't trade the experience for anything. And I know how much it meant to our guys. And I can't wait to get back and do it with another group.
What does it mean to you? And I know the answer to this, but I want you to espouse it. What does it mean to you to be a part of the Philadelphia basketball community?
It's everything to me. And I don't think there's a more unique group or community in basketball anywhere in the world than what we have here in Philadelphia. The history, the tradition, the players, the coaches, the personalities around the game. We all know, you know, the types of people we're talking about there. There's nothing like it. So to have just a small place in that is so special. I mean, that's what, as a little kid, I think I saw more than anything is I saw that. And from a very young age, you know, wanted to feel like, you know, you were able to be part of that. And the thing I've learned as an adult, it's not just on game day. It's every day. It's, I can call up countless coaches in this area and ask for advice. And it's those small moments out on the recruiting trail. And everyone is so supportive of each other and just tries to pick each other up and has each other, you know, everyone's back and respects each other so much. There's just, it's hard to put it into words, to be honest, even though I tried. And those relationships and those people make the hard days and the tough days and the days where you feel like you're just, you know, spinning your wheels so much easier. So it's a very unique thing. And again, I wouldn't trade it for the world that I've been a part of it for, you know, almost a decade or, you know, 2 decades now.
And to wrap up here, I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone who has had a more unique journey to where they are than you in the realm of head basketball coaches. How often do you take a step back and think about, man, how did I get from manager at St. Joe's to here? I drove a limo for a while in the middle. Like, it's a really, really incredible journey. How often do you take a step back and just kind of appreciate the journey that got you to where you are now?
Well, again, I'm a very egotistical person, so I think that there was a part of me that always thought I'd be here. I'm just kidding. I mean, no, you know, before this year, before COVID, not very often. I mean, honestly, before COVID, I you know, you never, you just don't have the time, you know, even in the, like, the one thing I didn't say about winning the championship was the best. So I'll go back to that just for a second. The best thing that winning and going to the NCAA tournament allowed me to do and to realize was all of a sudden, and you know this, you get all these texts and you get calls and messages and everything else. I mean, your phone is just, it's flooded with things. And it gave me the chance to say thank you to so many people. and people that made huge impacts, whether it's Daryl Keckler, whether it's Rob Nugent, whether it's Lynn Rothenhofer, my former AD here who hired me, obviously someone like Phil and the other guys that were on staff there. It allowed me to realize that I didn't do this on my own, that this wasn't one person's journey, that this wasn't one person's destination, that there were countless people who helped me become the coach and the person I am today. And I think it where I certainly have that arrogance and that ego, it also humbles you and allows you to keep this perspective that I don't know anything. I'm still learning. I'm still just that guy in 2008 or that guy back in 1999 that didn't know anything about this game, and keep that perspective. And then you combine that with the COVID and being physically removed from doing so many of these things, and it allows some space for what you're talking about. And it allows some space to say, wow, this has, you know, been quite the journey. Hopefully it's not over.
Bobby Hughes, thanks so much for taking the time. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it.
And that will do it for this week's episode. Want to thank Bobby Hughes, head men's basketball coach at Rosemont College, for being our guest this week. Now, if you like this show and you want to help us out, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on Twitter at OneOnOnePod. You can follow me on Twitter as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and tune in again next week when we bring you another great conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
What's good, y'all? It's Von Miller, Super Bowl MVP, SAG Master, and now your host of Free Range. This is where NFL meets real talk. Every week, I'm bringing you inside the game, from locker room stories to league-wide headlines. You want football IQ, locker room insight, and real conversations with the people shaping the league? Welcome to Free Range with Von Miller, where nothing is off limits and every down counts. New episodes every Wednesday. Listen and follow Free Range with me, Von Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.